Today, the intergenerational Game of Thrones. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly, the 25th of May, 2019. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest edition of our weekly Finance and Property Digest to the 25th of May 2019. This past week, the world changed and markets are now at an inflection point as the coalition won the election, the US-China trade wars went up a notch, Brexit claimed yet another UK Prime Minister, and locally, the property market has allegedly turned as the hype was amped up to 11. Behind it all, the intergenerational Game of Thrones is playing out, and the oldies are the winners. Let's deal with the international context first. Wall Street's major stock indices edged higher on Friday after falling in the previous session on comments from US President Donald Trump that he saw a resolution of the trade war with China, quote, happening fast. He added that Chinese telecom company Huawei, which the White House had blacklisted, could also be included in a trade deal. Earlier this week, the US Commerce Department rolled back some of the restrictions placed on Huawei for 90 days. This despite the fact that no high-level talks between the United States and China have been scheduled since the last round of negotiations in Washington 2 weeks ago. And there was a warning from Beijing that it's not above launching further countermeasures. The Shanghai Composite rose 0.02% to 2,852. And in US economic news, core durable good orders fell more than expected in April, pointing to underlying weakness in manufacturing demand and raising fears of slowdown in the broader economy. Yet Trump's comments were enough to give a slight lift to US stocks in muted activity ahead of a long weekend. Monday is the Memorial Day holiday. Friday marked the lowest volume of the year for a full trading session. Financials, telecoms, and basic materials sectors led shares higher. And shares in Boeing rose as much as 3% to more than a two-week high on Friday after reports that the Federal Aviation Administration expects to approve 737 MAX jets to return to service as soon as late June. Shares of the world's biggest plane maker have fallen nearly 15% since the fatal crash of an Ethiopian airline 737 MAX jet in March, erasing about $40 billion in market value. It ended at $354.90, up 1.24%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.37% to 25,585. The S&P 500 gained 0.14% to 2,826. The S&P 100 rose 0.11% to 1,250. And the Nasdaq Composite added 0.11% to 7,637. Even so, the S&P 500 ended the week more than 1% lower to notch the third straight week of losses. For the week, the Dow declined 0.68%, the S&P 500 fell 1.16%, and the Nasdaq dropped 2.29%. The Dow slid for the fifth straight week, its longest such losing streak in 8 years, while the S&P 500 and Nasdaq each registered their first three-week declines of the year. Financials led percentage gains amongst the S&P 500's major sectors, adding 0.8% as US Treasury yields rose for the first time in 3 days, and the 10-year Treasury yield rose 0.23% to 2.342. But the S&P Financials fell 1.49% to 441.03, and the 3-month yield was down 0.5% to 2.342. The volatility index was down 6.32% to 1585, and gold futures were down 0.09% to 1284. And elsewhere in commodity trading, crude oil rose 1.88% or 1.09 to hit $59. The euro US dollar was up 0.27% to 1.1211, while the US dollar index was down 0.25% at 97.61. And Bitcoin was up 1.32% to 7,976 as buying pressure allowed it to continue climbing higher after briefly dropping as low as $7,500 over the past couple of days. Although that surge above $8,000 is certainly positive, it is still struggling to move higher as it faces strong selling pressure around its current price. Analysts are now noting that Bitcoin must continue to surge and decisively close above $8,200, or else the cryptocurrency's bullish momentum may stall, leading to another pullback. The optimism in Bitcoin has triggered fresh fund flows into other cryptocurrencies, boosting the total crypto market capital rising to $252 billion from $235 billion a day earlier. The Brexit mess continues, with Prime Minister May announcing her resignation, but the change of leader will not make much difference to the dilemma Britain is in, with the country split on Remain or exit. In fact, a polar solution rather than a compromise looks more likely now. The FTSE was up 0.65% to 7,277, while the S&P Financials rose 0.5% to 690. The pound US dollar rose 0.48% to 1.2715. Meanwhile, Deutsche Bank continued to languish in what I believe is possibly one of the greatest risks to the financial system. We discussed this yesterday in our post, How Low Can Deutsche Bank Go? The risk from their massive derivatives book reaches out through the financial wiring of the global system to banks in many countries. And as we discussed, the exposures are enormous. So, to the local market. This week marked a significant rotation towards the financial sector and away from those not impacted by Labour's proposed changes to negative gearing, capital gains and franking credits, which would have hit a large number of older Australians. The ASX 100 was down 0.48% on Friday to 5,332, but strongly up towards its all-time high of 5,454 back in November 2007, before the GFC hit. It is now 7.34% higher over the past year. Announcements this week from APRA on weaker mortgage lending standards, see our post, APRA Consult on Reducing Mortgage Prudential Standards, and the RBA's signalling of lower mortgage rates gave the financial sector another boost. The ASX Financials was down 0.45% on Friday, having rocketed higher earlier in the week, and is now 1.23% higher than a year back, although still below its peak of 6,425 back in 2018 at 6,178. Local volatility, as measured by the ASX VIX, was at 1350, up 1.25% higher on the day, but down 3.02% from a year back. The major banks saw their shares back in favour, with the ANZ at 2784, down 0.36% on the day, and 0.65% over the past year, and well off its 12-month highs of 30.39. CBA hit a new 12-month high at 78.18 on Friday, up 0.04%, and up 10.87% over the past year. NAB was up 0.12% to 25.81, still down 5.25% from a year ago and below its 2018 high of $29. And Westpac was down 0.14% on Friday to 28.12 and is down 1.98% over the past year, having reached a peak of 30.44 in 2018. So the point to make is, yes, bank stocks have recovered somewhat, but CBA apart, they are not that stellar, despite all the hype. Regionals fared rather differently, with the Bank of Queensland down 0.77% to 905 on Friday, and still down 12.42% over the past year, and down from its peak of 1171 back in 2018. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank fell 1.7% on Friday to 1098, up 0.55% over the year, and off its high of 1187 back in 2018. And Suncorp fell 1.14% to 1390, up 2.51% over the year, but well off its high of 1588. If the majors do power up their mortgage lending, of course, the regions will get squeezed some more. As expected, property-related stocks did better, as the markets are now expecting better news from that sector. McGrath rose in the week to 24.5 cents, but is still down 27.9% over the year and down from its peak of 43.5. On the other hand, Yellow Brick Road ended at 6.4 cents, down 39.05% over the year and from a high of 12.5 cents. Mortgage aggregator Mortgage Choice bounced after the broker-friendly coalition returned, but fell 2.38% on Friday to end at 1.025, down 47.77% over the year and from a peak of 2.04. The point to make here is yes, there was a bit of a bounce, but key financial shares are just coming back to normal levels. Nothing really spectacular, yet some in the media have said this is massive. We are not so sure. Remember that the reason the RBA now seems willing to flag rate cuts is because the economy is performing poorly, with flat household incomes and rising costs, meaning that households are spending less. The question is, of course, will rate cuts help? Well, they might a bit if banks pass the cuts on, and there is behind-the-scenes pressure being applied by the government to insist they do. But of course, this may benefit mortgage holders, but will hit savers once again, who have taken the brunt of rate falls in the past couple of years. And will it really encourage businesses to invest in a weakening economy? Not necessarily. Retail is in trouble. For example, the Reject Shop's chief executive has quit after the troubled retailer announced store closures and slashed its full-year guidance to predict a loss of up to $2 million. They said the continuing absence of real wage growth and increases in the costs of many basic expenses, including mortgage rates, ensures that competition for the discretionary spend of consumers remains high. Seven stores will close by the end of June after the company was able to negotiate acceptable rents, leaving a network of 357 outlets. It did not say which stores would close. What we do know is that rate cuts will weaken the Aussie. It dropped below 70 cents, its previous floor, and spent some of the week at 68 cents. Thanks to a weaker US dollar, it rose a little on Friday, up 0.39% to 69.26. But have no doubt the weaker dollar will have consequences as we import inflation and investors get less interested in investing in Australia. Sure, it may help our exports, but as I said, there are consequences. It seems to me that the bad economic management that we've seen is now coming home to roost. This is why they are now trying to persuade people to come back into the housing market, with the first-time buyer incentives, the promise of lower cash rates, and looser lending. This is part of a concerted campaign, unnatural acts, as I call them, to try and cajole people back into the market. The strategy is blatant, to try to stop home prices falling further, which would be a better way to solve housing affordability, by the way, and to encourage households to spend, spend, spend. But it will not be simple. Mortgage underwriting standards are still tighter, and we expect announcements soon from lenders on a revised, tighter set of household expenditure measure parameters. They still want to use spending benchmarks, but they will be tighter. But then, the optimists, such as Christopher Joy in the AFR, are getting the hots for price rebounds. If the Reserve Bank of Australia cuts its cash rate twice, with the first likely in its June meeting, I expect national house prices to climb at least 5 to 10% over the 12 months following on from the final move. And on Wednesday, the RBA was privately telling bankers that they should pass through 100% of its June cut, and potentially more, given the sharp compression in funding costs. Our analysis, he said, indicates that APRA's change will enhance this person's borrowing capacity by 14%, with the impact growing as home loan rates fall. If the RBA cuts twice and the cheapest home loan rate falls from, say, 3.5% to 3%, our analysis suggests that borrowing capacity will lift by 20%. Frankly, we are less convinced. As Jarek Miller put it, policy is set to be eased in Australia. Tax rebates for low and middle income taxpayers, RBA rate cuts, and looser macroprudential restrictions. While these are helpful, they seem too late to prevent a downturn in residential construction. But the big question is whether wealth effects from already seen house price declines bite the consumer. If they do bite, these measures will be too little, too late. Housing has been the backbone of domestic growth for 5 years, but now seems set to turn down. The decline in building approvals over the past year points to residential-related activity, building, trading and furnishing homes, subtracting around 1% from GDP. But the more significant support for growth has been the wealth effect, the willingness of reduced savings as house prices rise. Consumer spending has persistently outpaced income growth over the past few years as saving has fallen. The simple point is that Australia may already have been flirting with recession if not for this saving decline. Nominal household disposable income growth is running at only 2%, near zero in real terms. If the saving rate had flatlined, real consumer spending accounts for 55% of GDP would have shown no growth. Or as Bloomberg put it, there are at least 80,000 reasons to suggest there will be no rapid rebound as the worst housing slump in a generation spreads deeper into the economy. That's how many apartments were completed in recent years in Sydney, adding around 5% to the housing stock, while Melbourne and Brisbane have also seen relatively large additions, according to the Reserve Bank. That raises the question, who's going to soak up all that new supply? On a recent Saturday morning in Wentworth Point, a suburb of high-rise apartments in West Sydney that largely sprung up during a five-year housing boom, the hordes of potential buyers seen at the peak has slowed to a trickle. Hi, excuse the interruption, but if you are getting value from this post, please consider subscribing to DFA if you haven't already done so, or ring that bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. The links are in the comments below. And thanks for supporting what we do. It's really appreciated and makes it possible for us to continue to make more great content. And CoreLogic said that the typical capital city home took 67 days to sell in March 2019, compared with 40 days at the same time in 2018. It does vary by region, but the trend is clear. More property listing, taking longer to sell. Now, some will point to the auction results, election weekend of course, as a sign of improvement, with a national clearance of 55.2% and a 60.7% result in Melbourne. Well, maybe, but the volumes are still well down on a year back and only 425 properties cleared. It will be interesting to watch the results over the next few weeks for signs of life. As Shane Oliver from the AMP said, auction clearance rates in Sydney and Melbourne have risen from their December lows, but this looks largely seasonal, with clearance still weak at pre-boom levels, just above 50%, as are sales volumes. What's more, the number of capital cities seeing monthly price falls has gone from 3 out of 8 a year ago to now 7 out of 8. Given all these considerations, we've been reluctant to read too much into the slowing in downwards momentum in monthly property price falls in recent months, particularly given that Perth and Darwin have seen several phases where price declines slowed, then sped up again during their five-year slump. He revised his price forecast slightly. Our forecast for national average prices have been for a price fall of 15% top to bottom, of which we have done 10% so far. And for Sydney and Melbourne, it's been for a price fall of 25% top to bottom, of which Sydney has already done 15 and Melbourne 11, and for prices to bottom in 2020. Reflecting the considerations discussed above, notably the removal of the threat of changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax, imminent rate cuts, assistance for first-time homebuyers, and APRA's relaxation of the 7% serviceability test, we are revising the estimate for Sydney home prices to a 19% top-to-bottom fall, Melbourne to 15% top-to-bottom, partly because it's been holding up much better, largely reflecting stronger population growth, and the national average to 12% top-to-bottom, with prices likely to bottom by year-end. However, given still poor affordability, still very high debt levels, tighter lending standards and rising unemployment, a quick return to boom time conditions is most unlikely. More likely is a lengthy period of constrained range-bound house prices after they bottom later this year. Although, he said, I thought the same around 2011-12, but things are different now. And Citi also upgraded their forecast. We now expect house prices to show year-on-year growth of 3% by December 2020. Meantime, the latest home price data showed improvements in Sydney this week, and as a result, the five-city average stayed put. So the CoreLogic Index to the 23rd of May 2019 shows that over the last week, Sydney prices rose 0.12%. Over the month, they dropped 0.6%. Over the quarter, they were down 2.36% annually, they dropped 11%, and from peak, they are now 15.1 down. In Melbourne, they fell 0.04% over the last week, 0.23% over the last month, down 1.63% over the last quarter, down 10% annually, and down 11.1% from the last peak. In Brisbane, they fell 0.06% over the last week. They fell 0.25% over the last month, down 1.3% over the last quarter, down 2.3% over the last year, and down 1.9% from their last peak. In Adelaide, they fell 0.06% over the last week. They were down 0.11% over the last month. They were down 0.45% over the last quarter. They were up 0.3% over the last year, and from peak, they were down 0.8%. In Perth, they were down 0.53% last week, down 0.72% over the last month, over the quarter, down 1.92%, annually, down 8.7%, and from peak, down 19%. And the average across the major five centres were weekly down 0.01%, monthly down 0.45%, quarterly down 1.89%, annually down 8.9%, and from peak down 10.7%. And looking at the annual movements based on the CoreLogic series, in Sydney, there was just a very slight rebound, but still around 12% down. In Melbourne, they're still falling. Brisbane continues to drift lower. Adelaide, pretty static. Perth, considerably down still. And across the five centres, there was just a slight adjustment up thanks to the recent change in Sydney. But more broadly, Fitch said of the Australian economy this week, slowing growth remains a key risk to the fiscal outlook. We forecast real GDP growth to decline to 2% in 2019 from 2.8% in 2018 amid spillovers from a slowing housing market on dwelling investment and consumption and sluggish income growth, external risks from rising trade tensions and the potential indirect effects on commodities demand also remain. A sharper than expected economic slowdown would affect revenues beyond our current base case and could add to political pressures for more fiscal stimulus. Positively, the unemployment rate remains low and the labour market has proved resilient, though labour market indicators have softened slightly in recent months, in line with our forecasts. A large pipeline of public infrastructure mitigates risks of a sharper downturn. The implementation of limited personal income tax cuts, as included in the April budget, could also improve some support to growth. However, using some of the recent upswing in revenues makes the fiscal trajectory more sensitive to commodity prices and GDP and wages growth. Commodity prices have remained buoyant, lifting exports and corporate profits, despite US-China trade ructions and the slowdown in Chinese economic growth. High household debt remains a risk for both the overall economy and the financial sector. And Fitch expects the ongoing home price correction to remain orderly, with prices declining 5% in 2019, but a sharper correction could exacerbate risks from high household debt. Debt service is low at current interest rates, but households remain vulnerable to a labour market or interest rate shock, although neither is expected in their base case. They say, we revised our monetary policy forecast in March and expect the Reserve Bank of Australia to cut its policy rate by 25 basis points to 1.25% in 2019. We forecast Australian growth to rebound to 2.5% in 2020. Westpac, on the other hand, is now calling three rate cuts to 0.75% from the RBA. There were two key communications this week, the May meeting minutes and a speech by Governor Lowe. In the May minutes, an easing bias was clearly evident, with the board noting that without an easing in monetary policy over the next 6 months, growth and inflation outcomes would be expected to be less favourable than our central scenario. In his follow-up speech, Governor Lowe went further, stating that at our meeting in 2 weeks' time, we will consider the case for lower rates. With respect to policy, Governor Lowe's focus was on the labour market, noting that the Australian economy can support an unemployment rate of below 5% without rising inflation concerns, with considerable slack also apparent in underemployment and wages, and leading indicators pointing to a deterioration in employment growth in the coming months, there is clearly a need and willingness on the part of the RBA to act quickly. With a cut in June locked in, the next question is how much further does the cash rate need to fall to right the economy? When we introduced our 2019 rate cut view in February, we penciled in, they say, two cuts. However, evident in the May statement on monetary policy forecast is the RBA's view that two more rate cuts would only get inflation and growth back to barely acceptable levels. Growth at trend and underlying inflation at 2% in 2019 and 2020. Our own forecasts and recent data imply that risks to this view are clearly to the downside. And so, following this week's clear guidance by Governor Lowe that the RBA is willing to proactively support the economy in pursuit of lower unemployment and strong wages growth, we have not only moved the two cuts we were forecasting forward to June and August, but also added a third in November. Following this course would take the cash rate down to 0.75% and the Aussie to 66 cents. Below that, they will, we think, get the QE toolkit out. As Westpac put it, arguably the RBA may see our current forecast of 0.75% as the base or possibly as low as 0.5%. Beyond 0.5%, QE seems to be the more effective policy if further easing was required. The most likely form of QE would include the RBA purchasing asset-backed securities issued by the non-banks or providing attractive funding for the banks secured against their securitized portfolios of mortgages aimed at supporting existing borrowers and possibly tied to new lending targets. These policies may well be needed to help the RBA move towards its key objectives, but are more likely issues for 2020 rather than the immediate challenges which are faced in 2019. But these are more reasons for savers to get nervous, as they are forced to eat into their capital or take higher risk investment strategies, as money in the banks will not return anything worthwhile. And the strategy is simply to balloon the debt further. The point I wanted to make today is that the election was swung by the majority of older Australians with assets and property voting for the coalition in the hope of retaining their wealth, shares and property, plus franking credits, at the expense of cheaper home prices, plus those voting for more jobs. All this is making it harder for younger Australians to follow their wealth-creating elders. Not only do many younger Australians have debt accumulated through their education, less secure work and compressed incomes, but the ability to save is being eroded with lower interest rates. The incentives for first home buyers will not have much effect, by the way. Debt is high across all age groups. The banks love this, of course, but is highest among younger age groups. Thus, there is an intergenerational tussle in play here, and one which is also manifest in issues like how best to tackle climate change and household finances. Now, prior to the election, I was seeing this coming through in our household surveys to the point that it seemed to me the coalition would win. Now, I should have made more of this at the time, but I was concerned that my data was out of kilter with the public polls. Well, we know now that the surveys were accurately portraying the intergenerational issues in play. It will be interesting over the next couple of months to see how this morphs and whether as a result household finances and buying intentions change. It does seem to me that the intergenerational inequality which we see is going to get worse as the debt bomb is reloaded. And just to finish the story of the week, the Aussie Gold Cross was down 0.29% on Friday to 1,854, up 8.83% over the year. And the Aussie Bitcoin Cross was down 10.09% to 8,301, down 9.18% over the year. It reached a high of 11,372 last year at its peak. The next few weeks will certainly be interesting, and there'll be plenty to discuss on the DFA channel as we progress. I noticed a few wise guys saying that I would have nothing to talk about now as home prices are set to rebound. Well, you know who you are, but I would simply say things are not that simple. The global financial landscape is getting pretty nasty, and as we discussed this week in a live stream, the scenarios are still pretty concerning. As I say, plenty to discuss. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.